I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Relax. Remove your bicycle clips.
Readjust your chain movement.
And join us, Jules and Jim, on Jules and Jim's Joyride. Hear it happens right here now. The unvarying monotony of that anodyne polka, Had Me Close to Slumber, is not something you might hear about today's guest, for his music is peppery and piquant, soothing yet feverish, and has awoken feelings in me I long thought dormant.
That's a very good way of describing him.
David Arnold.
Marvellous. Well, welcome, David. Much.
Thank you.
Can I just congratulate you on that introduction? It was beautiful and mellifluous words.
There was a lot of flowers in there, wasn't it? Floral. Yes. It was a floral introduction.
I think the fact that anyone takes any time at all to think about introducing me is a great compliment.
Well, I think you're
right. Have you ever been introduced?
I've been introduced, but it's usually, you know, a list of films and here he is.
Yeah, the accused is about to enter. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, that was poetic.
It took us on a little journey, didn't it?
And speaking of that, your journey here has been fraught with traffic.
Well, it's certainly fraught with traffic. I always like driving, mainly because I suppose I don't really get as much time to drive as I used to. And I'm not a petrolhead at all. I do not care about cars. I care not a jot about cars. But I quite like it just for having a bit of headspace. And a lot of the time, if I keep the radio off, I'll think of ideas when I'm driving. Like when I was doing Stargate and I was trying to think of a theme, and I was driving on the M1 past Toddington Services and it popped into my head fully formed, and I got no idea why that happened. The music kind of turns up completely. So when something comes into my head, I don't hear like a snippet of something. I just wonder what that could be. It's usually like fully formed and I can hear the whole thing. And when I play it back, even if it's that little bit, I immediately remember where I was, and I can immediately remember everything around it, you know, like the colour of it and the tone of it. And then the hard work, I suppose the craft part, is getting it out of your head and into the world so it can be played.
But the Stargate music.
Yes.
Did you write that down as the Toddington Symphony?
I wrote it. No, it's like most of these things, it's like when you record them, it's like that's all I was thinking about at the time because it was a big deal and I hadn't really done any films. Well, I'd done one film. I did that Young Americans film. And someone in America heard one of the cues from the Young Americans. There's this big sequence where someone was... It was a funeral, you know, and it was a big kind of like Morricone-esque thing and had choir on it. And it was like properly going for it in a sort of Hollywood score thing. Probably more so than the scene actually really demanded, but I thought I might not ever get a chance to do this again. So I did it. Anyway, so they liked this. Someone in America heard it and liked it and introduced that piece of music to Roland Emmerich, who was developing Stargate at the time with Mario Casar at Carolco. And I was sharing a flat with Danny Cannon, who was a director of Young Americans, and he was being asked to direct Judge Dredd. So we were both from Luton. We both grew up in Luton. And we had done like lots of little ideas and films together. And The Young Americans was the first one that actually got commercially released. And it took 8 or 9 years for that to happen. From the point where we met to the point where that came out, it was 8 or 9 years. Now, the journey from there, from the nothing to having a film out, is in a way the most, it's far more interesting than from the point when you get a film out to the next film to the next film. Because when you have something that does well, you know, people have more confidence in you.
Yes.
just because you've had success, regardless of the work. They just think, well, this film did well and he was part of it, so let's get him to do the next one.
Let's do that again, yeah. And also, presumably, that's a short journey because everybody wants to do that straight away. But what you're saying is the journey from somebody, from the idea of something, when nothing's happened before, when it's a brand new idea, to getting it made is quite a big journey.
Yeah. And in a way, that journey, career-wise, is not dissimilar to the journey of the humming at Toddington Services to having it played by an 85-piece orchestra Air Studios a year later, you know. But I mean, certainly the most interesting things that have ever happened to me, I think, have been the things that I had to do to stay alive, from deciding I was going to be a musician to being paid. That 10 years I was on agency lists, and when you're in an agency, you're basically the person that people call when no one wants to do a particular job. Something is so awful that no one who regularly works there will do it, and we get an agency guy in. So you got in this van with a bunch of people.
And hang on, who were these?
I didn't know who musicians. They were. It's like you turn up at an office in Dunstable. I registered myself as available to work.
As a musician?
As a person who would like do hod carrying.
Oh, just any work. Old work. It's like, I thought you were talking about there's a bunch of musicians.
No.
What, yes, in the back of a van that
film music. I thought you were talking about film music that nobody else would do. Like, this film's so rubbish. We just get the agency.
God, I
now,
wish.
This is even steps down from there. So this is agency just doing anything, right?
Because I think you were on the telly at the time a lot. And I'd be watching you like on a Friday night, I think. And then the next day I know that I would be cleaning out the inside of a cornflakes oven with a J-cloth and a bucket of bleach.
But that's probably what you were doing the next day, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was my weekend job.
Yes, after being on television.
Cleaning out a cornflakes oven?
Yes.
Yeah, it was in Letchworth.
They make cornflakes?
No, this was the place where they manufactured the ovens that would then get shipped to where they made cornflakes, and the cornflakes would then be cooked in it. It was like about as big as this room. It was an enormous circular oven that was welded together, and there were lots of sort of grease marks and welding marks and stuff on the inside. So I had to climb in through a ladder, and I had a bucket of bleach and a J-cloth, and they said, you've got to get rid of any marks that you can see on the inside of this oven before we ship it to Kellogg's, who were going to make their cornflakes in it. That was like one job, but that was like all day and very boring.
I'm just picturing, did that inspire you to maybe do a cornflakes overture?
I never got inspired by anything that I did in that regard. Like, at one point, I was working in the computer room of a ping pong ball factory.
And these are good jobs.
Yeah, and also dart boards, like sisal dart boards. Because there are two sorts of manufacturing of dart boards. There's sisal, which is hairy string. And the reason for you have sisal is that when a dart goes in, when you pull it out again, it heals itself because it's like little fibres, you know, so you don't get holes in it.
It'd be quite good to have if we were putting ourselves in a situation at risk, if we were doing some espionage, Jim, we could have jackets like that.
Yeah.
And if your enemies were armed with darts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it would fare against bullets.
So you got in a van in the morning, you didn't know where you were going to turn up.
No, you didn't really know what you were going to be doing. I've never felt such a sort of sense of camaraderie than being in the van going up to some of these places.
Yeah.
They were incredibly friendly and they didn't know me, you know, and I'd done all right at school, you know, but I was thinking, I'm doing this because next week I'm scoring a student film, so I'm going to do a week of this, and then, you know, I lived at my mum and dad's house, and then I'm going to go back home and I'm going to write a student film, and then I'd go out and earn a bit more money doing all these other things. I was doing gigs and things as well in pubs and in clubs, but just on a day-to-day basis. I worked at B&Q, selling carpets, British Bakeries. Marks and Spencer's have their own production line at British Bakeries, so they have their own ingredients and their own stuff, which is just better, which is why it's always nicer. And that was interesting.
The ping pong balls I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Because isn't there something particular? What are they made out of?
They're made of a cellulose. Tossed in a kind of odd kind of chemical, tiny little pearly things. I don't know what they are. It's a bit like sand.
Sound delicious.
Make them circular. Is it true that the gas that's inside them, if you breathe it in, you slowly rise off the ground?
There is a gas that's in it in order to stop them misshaping as they're drying, I think, because they, you know, they're sort of half baked, you know, and tossed in this drum, which coats them in the thing, which gives them a bit of bite on them, so when you're playing with a rubber bat, then you've got some grip on it so you can make it spin.
And the golf balls, if you chop those in half, they're full of elastic bands, the little strings.
I thought they were like sort of, I was told they were like television screens. They imploded if you sort of tried to.
Yeah, if you were in Trafalgar Square cut one in half, all the rubber band strings would hurtle down Whitehall.
Mm.
One of the films that I did with Danny was we entered it
Danny
into
who?
The Danny Cannon, who's a film director. He's from Luton as well. We met at a little arts centre in Luton, and Danny used to make films with his dad's camera. His dad, actually, Roy Cannon, was a props man on The Prisoner. He did all the props for The Prisoner.
The big ping pong ball.
All that stuff, yeah, that was all him.
The giant ping pong ball.
Yeah. It was a weather balloon, wasn't it? Mm. And he worked on the Monty Python films and everything. So I went around his house, there were all these pictures up, and it was amazing. So Danny had some sort of knowledge about how film industry worked. But he was 16, 17 at the time, and I think I was 19 or 20. And we used to meet there, and I used to like playing piano or rehearsing, and we used to meet on the stairs and talk about films, and we liked the same things. And he said, I want to be a film director. I said, well, I want to be a film composer. He said, well, let's just do stuff. So for the next sort of 3 years, we made films together, you know, like the way that you would do anything if you were in a band. You know, you'd like demo around people's houses and practice in garages. And we'd buy a couple of smoke pellets from Luton Market and set them off in a room like this and have a lamp outside so it looked like Ridley Scott. And you'd make it as much of a film as you could. And I didn't have any equipment. I didn't have anything really, because I had one guitar and electric piano, but I didn't have any recording equipment. And round the corner from us was a Catholic church in Luton. And the guy who was the organist there, his name was John Rand, had a four-track reel-to-reel and a Yamaha, a DX7, a Drumulator, and a Jupiter 8 and a reverb unit. So this he had a recording studio as far as I was concerned. And he used to let me go there on a Tuesday night between 6 and 7 when he was having his tea to record whatever music I was writing for Danny's film. So I would have all these bits of papers there.
An hour once a week.
He'd let me go in and I would go like track one, play it, track two, find a sound, play it, track three, blah, blah, track four, blah, mix it down onto a cassette and then off out, and we go back down to the art centre and stick it on the film. And that was like how we did it for years. One of those films got in 1986, BBC ran a BBC Young Filmmaker of the Year competition. Alan Parker was the overall judge, and Danny's film won the whole thing. And Alan Parker suggested that he met with Danny, and he said, you should go to the National Film and Television School. I applied to go to the National Film Television School and didn't get in because I had no formal education in composition or anything. But anyway, Alan Parker was like really friendly and he said, you should come over to Hollywood and stay with me. So I did. And I went
over
there.
Just turned up at his door?
Sort of. He had a spare room. And I think his son, Alex and Jake, were both into music and everything and film music. And he was really nice to me. And he said, why don't you just hang around with Alex? And Alex had a job doing some sound in the sound editing department at Paramount, and I went in one day with him. But the amazing thing about it was the day before I was in Luton, right? Now I'm at the front of the gates at Paramount Studio going into it. And the thing that I really learned from that was that, you know, the idea of doing what you want to do, you can't be thinking about how do I do it, you just have to do something. It took a while for me to realize that. I think if I'd have figured it out earlier, but when there are no guidelines, when there's no sort of concrete path to how you do this, and when you look at like film composers all around the world, they've all found an odd way into it,
kind of like a bit of Foley work.
Well, it was
I love Foley. I've worked quite a few with Foley artists.
What is Foley?
It's a set of on any film that you, very often you'll have footsteps. That's a simple way. So yes, you'll have footsteps. So someone will walk on gravel.
Yes.
On a little gravel patch in a studio.
Yeah.
Or I did a radio play a couple of years ago about the Hartlepool monkey, and it had to get hung. So they had a noose with a dead weight on it to get the sound of someone, well, a monkey being hung. But also there was a fella who was in who was a monkey impressionist. So he'd do all this stuff.
There is a full-time monkey impressionist, is there?
That's his job, yeah. And he was in, because this monkey was supposed to be in a cage.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Age, but they didn't have a case. So what I had was Tesco's trolley. And he would sit in the trolley and rattle it about and make monkey noises.
You see, now there's exactly to get into that. What you're saying, to get into that job, I mean, there, you know, that there's no sort of careers information at school wouldn't have told you how you're going to do that, would they?
No, that's, you know, so you'd come from nowhere to do that. No. How do you find out if you're a monkey impressionist?
I got given a haunted monkey once.
A haunted monkey?
Yeah. It was wooden, and it was...
I thought I meant a real one.
No, it was wooden, but it had a rope tail. It had a waxed rope tail. I was working on a film in New York, and my music editor was of the dark side. You know, he liked dark things. And his house was full of taxidermy, you know, and the slightly sinister crows and vultures, yeah, and things that looked a bit scary. And we finished this film, which was incredibly difficult. And he FedExed me a wooden monkey, which was two-dimensional. It was not a relief three-dimensional object. It was a drawing of a monkey on wood that someone had cut out. It looked like it was, you know, old, and they painted it. And the tail was a heavily sort of varnished, like twisted rope, the sort of thing you would have on a cat and nine tails, or the handle of a whip. And I opened it. And I immediately felt like there's something really wrong with this. I wouldn't have it in the house. It's like, it felt so weird. I wouldn't have it in the house. So I put it in the accounts office at the studio next to my room at Air Studios. And it sat there, and weird things started to happen to things that were around it. You know, like all the machinery like broke. Like, it was just the water machine and the calculators and the things that were around. Everything, like, as soon as I put it there, everything started breaking down.
So it was the ghost of a mischievous monkey.
And nothing would work. And it was, like, really freaking me out. And one day I came in and it was on the floor. It was on the floor.
Got down there of its own volition.
Everyone denied touching it. And these were, like, quite older people that you'd think, like, they're not going to lie about that. And I thought maybe it's one of the cleaners. And I asked them. Wasn't them. They all denied everything. Anyway, so this thing was on the floor. So I put it back up. And then the next day I came in and it was split in two. And one end was at one end of the shelf and the other end was at the other end of the shelf. And so I phoned up this guy and I said, like, can I send it back to you? Because I feel like if I burn it, if I do something about it, then maybe whatever it is going to, you know, jump onto me.
Was it a voodoo monkey?
I got no idea. I didn't even want to find out about it. So I phoned up the guy in the end and I said, look, do you mind if I send this back to you? Because it's a bit, you know, a bit like gremlins, you know, it's like if you give it back to the original thing, then maybe it will travel and find its home and it will be all right. And I mean, when I did, it was in three parts. It had split into three different parts.
Every time
parts.
You turned away, it's sort of another...
The next day, it sort of... And everyone was saying...
Do you think it was trying to spore itself into... And so lots of different parts, so there'd been lots of it all over.
I did try and find some sort of counter measures. And one of the most effective ones was I had a little plastic model of Homer Simpson that if you balanced it on its head, it would stop making it do freaky things for a bit. But then I think it worked a way around that. And then started dividing up into three in order for it to get
to
away.
Do you know those programs, you get paranormal shows on TV, which they're always in the same places, like in a prison or a hospital,
yeah,
or an old house.
And only, you know, people only have torches underneath their chins.
Yeah. Well, I inadvertently watched one. I didn't intend to. I was flicking around on TV and I saw it and I thought, these things are all the same. Why don't they have maybe a haunted telephone box haunted by someone who maybe died in there after a terrible phone call, or, you know,
yeah,
or a haunted camper van?
I do often wonder why the majority of ghosts are like Victorian and Victorian children, and that you don't see ghosts of like ants or wasps or anything.
You once told me that John Barry handed you his baton.
Did I?
Yeah, he said he wanted you to take over his
no, that's
his crown.
Completely not true.
Did you make that up?
I don't even remember ever saying that. If I did, it might have been
one
of those nights. Yeah.
Good. I mean, I think it's best to stick with it. Go with it, you know.
Now, one of my favourite nights of the Groucho was with you and Bob, and we drank so much. I remember like going home without saying goodbye. And then I remember getting home and I'd walked and I had no idea how I got home. I know I'd gone into every corner shop on the way there and I'd ate a samosa. I'd bought a samosa at every corner shop that was open on the way home that night. And this was like on the other end of Camden, up in Belsize Park. So it was like Soho to Camden. It's probably 6 miles, is it? You know?
Yeah.
A lot of corner shops.
Uphill, a lot of corner shops.
A lot of samosas.
Well, that was the heady days of the 90s, wasn't it? But yeah, you told me, you said you and the new John Barry.
No, I'll tell you what it was like. People used to say, after I did Independence Day and Stargate, everyone said it's the next John Williams. And then when I started doing Bond stuff, it was like, it's the next John Barry. And I haven't been the next anything else for a while. And I don't know when you're ever you. You know, it's a weird thing, and it's like people like sort of telling you that you want to be the next this, that, or the other. But John was my principal introduction to film music when I was sort of 7 or 8 years old. Was I saw You Only Live Twice at the Luton British Legion Children's Christmas Party, the most inappropriate film to play for sort of 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds.
What was it?
You Only Live Twice.
Oh,
it starts off with, well, you've got the capsule in space, the big spaceship eating the little spaceship, which is phenomenal to look at. You've got the gun barrel sequence with the title. You've got the song with Nancy Sinatra with those strings. And then you have Sean Connery post-coitally being machine gunned to death and then dumped in the sea. And I was thinking, this is brilliant. And so the music really sort of hit home in a very big way. And within a month of that, I think I saw that. And then we went to Dublin and we saw Oliver and then The Jungle Book. Now, those three movies, all hugely stylish, but incredibly different and
the music,
very
and
strong
the,
on songs
as
well. Yeah,
very important music in all of those.
Yeah.
Great and, atmosphere.
And that was the thing that made me want to do that, I think. I mean, it took a while to get there. All those years of listening to, you know, to music. I mean, my mum and dad's record collection was largely, my dad had sort of classical music and all the standards, you know, the great, I suppose, crooners in a way. He was a singer as well. He used to be a boxer and then he turned to singing. So it was all like Jack Jones and Matt Monroe. And
your mum was a singer as well?
No, my mum was a typist at Electrolux and that's where she met me dad because he was at that point working in the factory. Anyway, so she had like the Beatles records and then also she'd have things like Vince Hill and then between them they had lots of songs from records from the musicals, you know, the great MGM musicals and the South Pacific and West Side Story and Carousel. So there was always music, constantly music in the house and I think that just gets into your system and I think it's a, you know, it's an important part of being a human being, I think, is to have music around.
And here's a message from our sponsors. Turn on your lights.
From your armchair.
Turn on your TV.
From your armchair.
Turn on your wife.
From your armchair.
With the new remote control.
From Bird's Eye Fish Fingers. Do you have any other hobbies that would engage you?
I've often thought about hobbies because it feels like it's something that I should be doing. I often think about things that maybe I should be doing that other people do, and I can't get over the pointlessness of it.
Looking at you, I would say a hobby you might want to try is maybe making chunky jewellery.
a friend of mine asked me if I would go out and play golf with him the other day.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. What did you say?
I said no. I said, because I can't see the point of it.
Mm.
I can't see the point of a lot of things, you know, like
what do you not see the point
of it? I mean, photography, I can understand that it's a nice thing to do, but I don't want to do that.
Get a dark room.
Like, even going for a walk. I mean, I know it's good for you, but I'm thinking, like, what's the point of going for a walk?
So all you do is think of music.
You end up where you started and you haven't really done anything other than gone for a walk.
Golf and if you do golf, it just ruins a good walk.
Yeah.
I mean, people have asked me to play golf, and I've got lots of good friends who really love it.
They
love
me golf. Too.
But it's the time doing it, making appointments in advance where you've got to sort of organise a load of stuff. And I, you know, I've got to get the equipment. I've got to get the buggy. And then
the pouch on wheels.
Yes, exactly. And a manservant to follow me around with my tray of drinks.
A caddy. Yeah, but you could have the opportunity of a caddy rushing up to you with a contract saying, sign here, Mr. Holland, and you can bat it away and say, not now, I'm busy.
Yeah, I'd like that bit. I'd do it if it was like that, yeah.
I feel the same about fishing as well. You could literally take a chair and go and sit and look at a river for 4 hours do the fishing bit, and you'd have it, and that would be the same experience, wouldn't it?
But would you do it, though? That's the thing, I suppose.
I go bird watching, but I can't sit in a hide for 6 hours.
Right.
I have to be on the move all the time, so I walk about. So then I'm getting the exercise walking about.
Do you have
That's
to disguise
purely because
yourself,
I can't sit
though?
Still.
Do you have to disguise yourself so the birds don't get frightened?
I've got a special camouflage suit, which makes me invisible.
Mm. Is it your mirrored suit that you wear here sometimes?
Yeah, it's a stealth suit.
Yeah,
but I can't sit still. I think that's one thing. You know, fishing, I can get people who want to do it if you just sit still, but I can't do
it. I understand it, I just don't want to do it. You know, the birds don't feel the heat from chili peppers.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, that's why they would. That's
did
why
they tell
chili
you,
peppers
did,
are hot. So it stops mammals from eating them. Because the whole thing is about trying to spread your seed as far as you can, right? So if you're a chili and the seeds are hot, it's so mammals don't eat them, because mammals don't travel very far. And so when they poo them out and the seed comes out with it because it's not digestible, you haven't spread your seed very far. But birds fly a much greater distance. So chilies have developed so birds don't feel the heat from it. So they can eat everything and then they'll go and poo a chili seed 2 miles away.
Mm.
That's the reason why flowers develop, because before, in the Cretaceous era, it was all, you know, when you see documentaries about dinosaurs and they've got filming of where they lived and it's all just ferns and there aren't any flowers, the plants used to rely on their seed being carried by the wind to get them as far away as possible. When wasps turned up and they would alight on certain things, I mean, this obviously happened over millions of years, but they said, hold on, if we can stick our stuff onto a wasp, then it can go much further than the wind will take it. And that's when they started developing flowers.
But of course, and if we move into the modern times, not the wasp so much, but the bees, of course, are very much used amongst the intelligence service community for bugging people, because you can then send a bee in with a bug. This bee's up in the corner minding his own business, and everybody's, you know, the world leaders are discussing whatever they're discussing.
With a tiny microphone.
Yeah, and then the wasp goes back to its handler, and not the wasp, it's a bee, rather.
Bee.
Yeah, yeah.
There's only, I think it's the female. Is it the female or the male wasp is the only one that stings? The other one doesn't.
Do you know that every fig is has got some dead wasp in it?
Yeah.
It's been very useful, this programme, I have
Isn't
to
it?
Say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I certainly hope people have got their notebooks out.
Yes.
And on that note...
Did we get very far? I'm not sure that we got very far.
We've got far enough.
Yeah, it's quite far enough, thank you.
I thought we were going to be talking about driving or travelling or something. And I thought at some point we're going to be talking about the sort of things that you want to talk about. Shall I tell you my bee joke, my favourite bee joke?
Please.
Yeah. A bloke goes into a pub and he's having a pint of beer at the bar and there's another guy next to him and... They start talking and he said, oh, what do you do? He goes, oh, I'm a beekeeper. He goes, that's amazing. He goes, I'm a beekeeper too. He goes, how many bees have you got? He goes, I've got 20,000. He goes, that's a lot of bees. He says, yeah, no, it's a lot of bees. He goes, where do you keep them? Keep them in a couple of hives. He goes, oh, that's nice. He goes, how many bees have you got? I've got 50,000. He goes, that's a lot of bees. He goes, no, it's a lot of bees. He goes, where do you keep yours? I keep them in one hive. He goes, isn't that a bit cramped? And the bloke goes, fuck them.
Yeah.
That's my only B joke.
Oh, God, thanks,
that's a good one. It's worth it.
Very good.
It's worth it, yeah.
Harry Hill was when asked, he kept bees, and they said, is it for the honey? And he said, no, it's for the pelts.
Have you got a good joke?
No, that was it. I'm using Harry Hill's
that one.
That one,
yeah.
Bee jokes. Yeah, I started listening to one of the things that I started doing whilst we were all locked up was listening to podcasts, which, you know, is kind of like a brand new genre now. And some of them are absolutely fascinating. I've been listening to these ones. There's one from America called Stuff You Should Know, which is just two slightly sort of nerdy sciencey guys who do an hour on a specific thing. And they go right into the minutiae of everything. And the first one I listened to was soap. They did soap, envelopes, wasps.
But what you're saying on this podcast that they do go into detail in factual detail about lots of about specific things. It's almost the opposite of this, where we skim across sort of vague imaginings and things and misconceptions and pontificate about things we don't know about at all. So, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, David.
You're very welcome. Yes. This is a joyous day out for me.
It's been a pleasure and a privilege having you chatting about film music and The Haunted Monkey, which sounds like a film in itself, really.
It's one of those ones that would be on Tuesday night. Tales of the Unexpected.
Let's get it written. Thank you very much. David Arnold. Well, there goes David.
Yeah, off on the Thames on the James Bond boat, zooming beneath the bridges with his lovely music playing in the background.
There he goes now.
This podcast was produced and edited by Molly Stewart.
Sound engineers were James Stewart and George Latham.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.